And now, America's number one show on pop culture and politics. This is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth. Not only a great nation, but a greatly fortunate nation. And Americans have never felt so fortunate, so privileged, so protected by a benign and smiling providence as we did at the end of 1914 and throughout most of 1915. Why? Because America was at peace. We were safe from all the bloodshed and all the horror and all the destruction that was going on in Europe as part of World War I. And the overwhelming majority of Americans, I mean, by very, very huge numbers, wanted to stay out of the war at all costs. So what changed? How did we go from that sentiment to a situation where 2 million American young men were sent across the Atlantic Ocean into the hellish fighting in Europe? That's the subject of this very special broadcast of the Michael Medved Show. It's called World War I, The Great War or America's Greatest Mistake. The strains of the patriotic rallying song Over There by George M. Cohan, saying that the Yanks are coming, the Yanks are coming, the drums rum-tumming everywhere. That wasn't a song that Americans were singing until 1917, after Woodrow Wilson decided, and yes, it was a personal decision ultimately, to take America to war. 2 years earlier, back in 1915, Americans were actually singing a very different tune.
I didn't raise my boy to be a soldier. I brought him up to be my pride and joy.
And joy. Who dared to place the musket on his shoulders to shoot the mother's darling boy.
Let nations love and raise their future troubles.
It's time to lay the sword and gun away.
There'd be no war today if mothers all would say,
I didn't raise my boy to be a soldier.
Believe it or not, this was the number one hit of the entire year, 1915. The song was a sensation, I didn't raise my boy to be a soldier. And the purpose of the song was very transparent, was very real. What you just heard, I know the lyrics are hard to understand, where I brought him up to be, I didn't raise my boy to be a soldier, I brought him up to be my pride and joy, who dares to place a musket on his shoulder to shoot some other mother's darling boy. Let nations arbitrate their future troubles. It's time to lay the sword and gun away. There'd be no war today if mothers all would say, I didn't raise my boy to be a soldier. And then the final verse says, what victory can cheer a mother's heart when she looks at her blighted home? What victory can bring her back all she cared to call her own? Let each mother answer in the years to be, remember that my boy belongs to me. And the sheet music for this song is astonishing when you look at it. The antique sheet music from 1915. It shows a white-haired mother gripping tight hold of her boy, who's sort of kneeling in front of her in front of a fireplace. And there's sort of a thought balloon where the mother is imagining the battlefields of Europe, and she's hugging all the tighter to her son. Now, not everybody gave a positive review to this song, even though it was very, very popular. Theodore Roosevelt, the former president, who was a big advocate for America taking a stronger line and for American preparedness above all, because we had a very small army at the time. We did not rank among the world's great military powers because we had disarmed so entirely and dramatically since the Spanish-American War of 1898. But in any event, Teddy Roosevelt said that I didn't raise my boy to be a soldier would appeal to precisely those sorts of people who would say, I didn't raise my girl to be a mother. He suggested that the place for women who liked the song and who opposed war was in China, or by preference in a harem, and not in these United States. And there were lots of parodies of the song, I didn't raise my boy to be a soldier. It was so popular. It was such a sensation One of the parodies was, I didn't raise my boy to be a coward. Another one said, I didn't raise my boy to be a soldier, but I'll send my girl to be a nurse. And another said, I didn't raise my dog to be a sausage, which I guess is probably a good and reasonable idea. Groucho Marx said that one of his favorite jokes of the time concerned a poker game in which a card-playing mom says, I didn't raise my boy, he had the Joker. This was the way America felt. The difficulty for Woodrow Wilson was that he felt the same way. He clearly did not want to take the nation to war, but he also tilted without any question at all toward the British side. And the British were increasingly engaged in what was an incredibly bloody war. Just to give you some indication, the casualty figures that were piling up in Europe as Americans watched in horror, they read in newspapers, increasingly they saw newsreels because they had newsreels in cinemas. The Battle of the Marne in September 1914, right after the war began, the British and French won a decisive victory. But they had 260,000 casualties in a week. In a week. This dwarfed anything in the American Civil War. Nothing was this bloody in the American Civil War, which before had been the record holder. I mean, 82,000 Allied troops died at the Battle of the Marne. About the same number of German troops. More than 150,000 people slaughtered in a week. By the way, later in the war, still before the Americans got in, the Battle of Verdun. It's unbelievable. There's been no battle like that really in history, except maybe the Battle of Stalingrad and the next World War. But at the Battle of Verdun in 1916, 700,000 dead, more killed in that one battle than in the entire 4 years of America's Civil War. No wonder Americans did not in any case at all want to get involved. But the problem was that it was tough to stay out when there were so many commercial interests in the United States and so much sentiment in support of the Allies. In other words, there seemed to be a consensus in the United States that people wanted Britain and France to win. They did not want Germany to win. That was particularly true after the cries of bloody Belgium went up. To invade France, which the Germans felt they had to do to protect themselves. The Germans, when they were fighting the war, felt encircled because they had Russia on one side and they had France on the other, both very formidable nations. And they were going to be forced to fight a two-front war. The French were also reinforced by about a million Brits who were fighting over in France. So the Germans felt that they had to strike first and immobilize France, and then they knew they'd have a longer war against the Russians. But to get to Paris, they had to sweep through Belgium. At least that was the decision of von Moltke and the other German military leaders. During the course of sweeping through Belgium, there was a great deal of hardship. There was a great deal of killing. The Belgians were officially neutral. So cries of bloody Belgium went up, and even those Americans who might have said, well, these two sides, they're both fighting for reasons that remain somewhat obscure, it put the Germans in a very bad light, especially with British propaganda very active in the United States. But even though most people in the United States of America tilted toward the British side and toward the French side, there was no desire on the part of most people, with the singular exception of Theodore Roosevelt and people who followed him very, very strongly, to get directly involved in the war. And that led the Secretary of State of the United States, William Jennings Bryan, who wanted above anything else to keep the world at peace. He had strong pacifist inclinations. He had been a longtime anti-imperialist. He opposed any loans to any of the belligerents, or allowing Americans to even travel into the war zone, because he rightly assumed that if you did that, that would raise cries for American involvement. The difficulty here was that the British were instituting a total blockade of Germany. They were planning to starve Germany out, and they had the ships and the navy to do it. And the Germans, using what was a very frightening new weapon at the time, the submarine, the U-boat, the Unterseeboot, the Germans were determined to stop the flow of munitions to Britain. So how did that implicate the United States? In a decisive and bloody way. More coming up.
You're listening to a special show, World War I, The Great War, or America's Greatest Mistake, on The Michael Medved Show.
Listening to a special broadcast of The Michael Medved Show, World War I, The Great War, or America's Greatest Mistake.
In the first months of World War I, the United States remained optimistic that we could maintain our neutrality, stay uninvolved, but we could still make a lot of money selling munitions, selling supplies, selling food, selling everything to the belligerents. That was a fiction, said the Secretary of State, William Jennings Bryan. He believed that Wilson would have to choose between his desire to see British victory and his desire to maintain American neutrality. And he would also have to choose between neutrality and affirming neutral rights. Now, what did that mean? What that meant was that Britain imposed a sea blockade, what was called a hunger blockade. They controlled the seas. The British Navy was the greatest navy in the world by far. Germany had built up a very formidable navy to challenge the British. They actually fought a standoff at the Battle of Jutland, huge naval battle. Neither side won decisively. But what that meant was that the British still controlled the Atlantic Ocean. And when they imposed their hunger blockade, it was even referred to in that way, was basically determined that they would starve Germany to a standstill, and perhaps even to surrender or to pulling back or to stalemate in the war that was raging on French soil in Europe. With all of this going on here in the United States, the Germans still believed that the American government would maintain its neutrality. One counselor in the German embassy in Washington seemed to know better. His name was von Hanyl. And he sent back a message to his bosses in Berlin, reminding them that, a quote, American feeling was the outgrowth of a natural connection with England in history, blood, speech, society, finance, and culture, and that in the present case, commercial instinct and sentiment point in the same direction. And what that direction meant was that within 3 months of the beginning of the war, Wilson had agreed to permit unrestricted trade in munitions and to lift the ban on loans and to interfere not at all with Americans who wanted to travel into the war zone. In all of these things, he was disregarding the advice of his own Secretary of State and the passionate advice of his own Secretary of State. Barbara Tuchman, writing about The Road to War, says that these two measures, permitting the unrestricted trade in munitions and lifting the ban on loans, those measures were not taken in the Allied interest, but in the American interest. To ban loans and embargo munitions would have closed off the wealth of unlimited orders, and Americans did not wish to suffer for their neutrality. Rather, they hoped to make a good thing of it. The problem is that the British could enforce a blockade on Germany, which meant that trade with Germany went down to almost nothing, while trade with Britain boomed, and Americans were making a lot of money on that. So with the German response, came in February of 1915, when they announced very dramatically that the government would attempt to destroy all enemy ships within a stated war zone around the British Isles. The submarine was the weapon that they would use to do it. They led the world by far in submarine technology. They had a formidable fleet of submarines, but there was a problem with it. With the British blockade, a ship could appear and it could turn away an opposing ship without sinking it. Submarines couldn't do that, because once the submarine came out of the water and you could see it, you could fire on it. And the British were arming their own merchantmen. They were arming their own ocean liners. And they had guns on those ships, and it could have shot the submarines. And these were flimsy contraptions. They were very early submarines. So the only thing the Germans could use their submarines to do is to send out torpedoes and to sink ships without warning. Wilson never accepted this fact. He accepted the British blockade, but he never accepted the German determination to sink even British shipping, let alone American shipping. Now, the Germans never fired on American ships, not on civilian ships. But they did fire twice on American ships who were accompanying British cargo ships as part of a convoy. The most controversial episode, of course, involved the Lusitania. This was a great ocean liner, one of those luxury liners. It had been built as a rival to Titanic. And it was at one time the world's biggest ship. But the Titanic never got as much service as Lusitania, but they ended up in the same fate. Because in May of 1915, the Germans sank Lusitania, this luxury liner. It went to the bottom, killing 1,198 people, including 128 Americans. There was, of course, huge outrage in the United States. They had newsreel footage that showed some of the sinking, and they could show that in motion picture theaters, and people gasped and they were outraged. The Germans said, wait, this ship, and the British admitted it, was carrying munitions on it, not just passengers. And we had warned the British that we would sink their ship, the Lusitania. And we had warned Americans by putting ads in newspapers saying, don't go on board this ship. It's going to be subject to our blockade. It didn't matter. The indignation was very much there. And what was interesting about this is that President Wilson did not have political support on this. Ultimately, his Secretary of State, his own Secretary of State, William Jennings Bryan, who was in many ways the most popular Democrat in the country, didn't agree with him at all. Bryan believed that Wilson had to choose between affirming neutral rights to travel on any ship you wanted or to ship to anyone you wanted, or his desire to stay out of the war. He couldn't have both. He pressed on the president the course he believed would keep us out of the war. He wanted Wilson to deny armed merchant ships of any kind entry to any U.S. ports and to forbid U.S. citizens from traveling on any vessels of belligerents. That might have avoided the whole parade to war. And when Bryan responded to Lusitania, he said, why be shocked by the drowning of a few people if there is to be no objection to starving a nation, referring to the German hunger blockade. Bryan ultimately resigned over the issue, and the last voice for true neutrality left the administration. Wilson was determined to rein in German submarine warfare, and he began talking about preparedness and negotiating with the Germans at the same time to get them to change their tactics so he could win a victory on that particular issue. The Lusitania sank in 1915. It was nearly two full years before war was declared. What happened in between gave us plenty of additional chances to avoid war. Those were chances that were not taken. We'll tell you why not coming up. Wilson's biographer, John A. Garrity, writes that if the president had accepted the not wholly unreasonable suggestion of the Germans that Americans stay off munitions-laden liners like Lusitania, no United States citizens would have been killed in the disaster. And as a matter of fact, as to the charge that his resigned Secretary of State, William Jennings Bryan, was somehow secretly pro-German, Garrity writes, Bryan was not pro-German, but he believed the German violations of neutral rights were not essentially different from Allied violations. He thought that the United States could force both sides to obey international law by threatening to cut off the flow of vital American supplies. Such a policy, if adopted, would probably have kept America out of the war, but it might well have meant that Germany would eventually have triumphed. Wilson was certainly influenced by Bryan's arguments, but unlike his Secretary of State, he could not accept the possibility of German victory. That was also increasingly true because of the economic dependence that America had, and more, on trade with the Allies and advancing loans to the Allies. So Wilson needed to confront the Germans about America potentially going to war unless they limited their unrestricted submarine warfare, which was beginning to be devastating to British commerce and, by implication, to American commerce. The problem was that the Germans didn't take us that seriously, because American military weakness, as Garrity writes, actually encouraged the Germans to take actions that forced the United States into the fight. As early as summer of 1915, right after Lusitania, the American ambassador in Berlin complained, quote, "The people here are firmly convinced that we can be slapped, insulted, and murdered with absolute impunity." Colonel House, the president's friend and advisor, was saying, "If war comes, it will be because we are totally unprepared, and Germany feels that we are impotent." So President Wilson began giving speeches about preparedness, calling for more federal spending, which he was very good at, but particularly for building up the U.S. Navy. But the problem was, in Congress, there was tremendous dispute about Wilson's demands about the submarine warfare. For instance, one of the leading Democrats in Congress, later the Democratic majority leader, Claude Kitchen of North Carolina, pointed out that if Americans would sacrifice their right to go on belligerent ships in the submarine zone as readily as they had sacrificed their equal right to try to force Britain's illegal North Sea mine zone, Germany would never have been guilty of taking any Americans' lives. And as a matter of fact, Wilson taking a position, "I cannot consent to any abridgment of the rights of American citizens in any respect. What we are contending for in this matter is of the very essence of the things that have made America a sovereign nation." Well, Richard Hofstadter, political scientist at Columbia, said that this was a rationalization of the flimsiest sort, for Wilson continued to accept a great deal more than a single abatement of right at the hands of the British without the same concern for the effect upon the whole fine fabric of international law. There were more disputes, and finally, partially because of the big push for American preparedness, there were 125,000 people, civilians, who marched in a preparedness parade down Fifth Avenue in New York City. There were 250 brass bands, and it was a huge deal. And by the way, this was also part of the way that Wilson was preparing for his reelection campaign. And just in time for the reelection campaign, in 1916, about a year after the sinking of the Lusitania, Wilson finally got the Germans to agree that they would no longer attack merchant shipping with submarines. And this was considered such a huge, huge achievement, it became the centerpiece of the president's drive for reelection. But that drive was all based upon one simple slogan, repeated again and again and again: he kept us out of war. This made it particularly difficult for that same president to lead to war within basically a month of being inaugurated for a second term. We will get to that and more in this special broadcast of The Medved Show.
You're listening to a special show, World War One, The Great War, or America's Greatest Mistake. MedvedHistoryStore.com.
As the European nations suffered through one bloody battle after another, Americans prepared for battle of another kind. It was the great election of 1916. Woodrow Wilson had been elected very much as a minority president because the Republicans had been split. This time, the Republicans had come together. Theodore Roosevelt had rejoined the Republican Party. He strongly supported the former governor of New York, a justice of the Supreme Court, Charles Evans Hughes. Hughes was an unbelievably distinguished guy who was respected by everyone, loved by almost no one. He was the last presidential nominee of any party with a beard. In fact, Roosevelt, though he supported him, sometimes referred to Hughes, because of his caution, as the bearded lady. But Hughes ran a strong campaign and won support from not only the Republican Party, but from the Progressive Party, bringing the progressives back into the fold, or at least most of them. Wilson, on the other hand, was running a campaign that had basically only one note. The note was, he kept us out of war. And he also followed a very, very interesting political strategy. And it was probably a very clever political strategy, because it helped him in this underdog fight. The strategy was to attack Roosevelt, not Hughes. Because Roosevelt, of course, had said all kinds of things that were frightening to people, because he believed that America should be involved to put an end to the war and to put an end to German ambitions. And he tilted very much in the British direction. For instance, he wrote an essay in 1960 called America First, A Phrase or a Fact. And basically, Roosevelt felt that the United States could not play a subsidiary role to any nation. We had to become the leader of the world. And the only way we could do that is by getting directly involved in the war. And he wrote, individuals and nations who preach the doctrine of milk and water invariably have in them a softness of fiber, which means that they fear to antagonize those who preach and practice the doctrine of blood and iron. The phrase blood and iron had been associated with Bismarck and the Germans, of course. And in response to that kind of talk, the Democrats held their convention, and they were electrified by one of the most remarkable and memorable keynote addresses. It was by a former governor of New York, Democratic governor of New York, named Martin Glynn. And he just drove the delegates crazy. He drove them into raptures, basically, by emphasizing the fact that that Wilson had not taken America to war. For instance, he said, without orphaning a single American child, without widowing a single American mother, without firing a single gun, without the shedding of a single drop of blood, the president has wrung from the most militant spirit that ever brooded above a battlefield an acknowledgement of American rights and an agreement to American demands, talking about the submarine warfare. And then Bryan himself got up, and William Jennings Bryan, the great commoner, said, my friends, I have differed from our president on some of the methods employed, but I join with the American people in thanking God that we have a president who does not want this nation plunged into war. They demonstrated and cheered beyond enthusiasm. And as a matter of fact, they adopted a special plank in response to Bryan's speech and in response to Glynn's speech. The plank said, in particular, we commend to the American people the splendid diplomatic victories of our great president, who has preserved the vital interests of our government and its citizens and kept us out of war.
Thanks for listening to this special presentation of The Michael Medved Show, World War One, The Great War, or America's Greatest Mistake.
After the Democrat convention, Wilson spoke to the Secretary of the Navy, Josephus Daniels. The Assistant Secretary of the Navy, by the way, was a young man named Franklin D. Roosevelt. But Wilson spoke to Josephus Daniels and he said, I can't keep the country out of war. They talk of me as though I were a god. Any little German lieutenant can put us into the war at any time by some calculated outrage. The campaign unfolded. Everyone knew it was going to be close. And on election night, it seemed apparent that Hughes had won a fairly comfortable victory and Wilson would be a one-term president. and the problem of avoiding war would go back to the hands of the Republicans. The difficulty was that there was a very, very close vote in California. And California's 13 electoral votes, and this is way out in the West Coast then, at a time where that was very distant, very far away, the California 13 electoral votes would have swung the election. Whoever carried California would win. Hughes went to bed confident that he had won. Wilson went to bed confident that he had lost. And there's a story about a reporter who knocked on the door of Hughes's home, and the butler came to the door and said, "The president is in bed and cannot be disturbed." The reporter then slapped shut his notebook and said, "Well, please tell Mr. Hughes when he wakes up that he's no longer the president." Wilson had carried California by 3,800 votes. That was it. And with it had won the election. He came back to Washington after November, happy that he had won. The Democrats had actually lost power in Congress over the years. The idea that Wilson had won some kind of triumphant election, it wasn't true. But the American people had clearly shown that they did not want the country to go to war. And in fact, they even supported some of the more remarkable examples of Wilsonian rhetoric. In response to Roosevelt in an earlier speech before the campaign, Wilson had even talked about being too proud to fight. In fact, he said, "There is such a thing as a nation being so right that it does not need to convince others by force that it is right. There is such a thing as a man being too proud to fight." So what led us to give up that sort of pride and to send 117,000 young Americans to their deaths? We will get to that and more in this special broadcast of The Medved Show.
Follow us on Facebook and Twitter at michaelmedved.com.
The fateful decision that led directly to America's entry into World War I wasn't made in the White House. It wasn't even made on Capitol Hill in the Congress of the United States. It was made at a place called Pless Castle. It was a German castle near the German-Polish border, where on January 9th, 1917, the top German commanders, Field Marshal Paul von Hindenburg, General Erich Ludendorff, the Admiral of the German Navy, Henning von Holzendorf, and the Chancellor, the top civilian leader of Germany, Theobald von Bethmann-Hollweg, all arrived. The Kaiser himself arrived just a few days later. He was irritable. He was upset. They were facing a desperate situation. Germany was being starved out by the British hunger blockade, and they had a proposal on the table to resume unrestricted submarine warfare. They needed to face two questions. First, would that bring America into the war? Second, could Britain then be defeated by the unrestricted submarine warfare before the Americans were able to get their military together and cross the Atlantic? The generals all assured the Kaiser that if they were given the right to let their submarines roam free and to prey on all the Allied shipping, that Britain could be defeated by that fall. And the Americans wouldn't have a chance to send anything across the way. The Chancellor, the civilian leader, said, "No, you cannot do this. You are underestimating what will happen if the Americans get into the war." And they all argued against him. And he basically, the argument against the Chancellor Bethmann-Hollweg was, look, the Americans are already providing all the supplies and all the munitions. They can't really do much more to help the British. So the Kaiser overruled him. and said, yes, starting on February 1917, right before Wilson would be inaugurated for a second term, we're going to start unrestricted submarine warfare. The Kaiser signed the order. The admiral and the generals stood up. They saluted. They marched out of the room. The chancellor stood behind, slumped down in his chair. His aide entered and said, Herr Chancellor, what's wrong? He said only two words, Fini Germaniae. Germany is finished. He had a sense of what was coming. The American people did not. But the fateful decision had been made in Germany and was followed up by a series of American decisions that changed our country forever, but allowed us nonetheless to remain the greatest nation on God's green earth.